witnessed an important political transformation in the last 50 years, and that is the rise of a conservative movement that transformed the Republican Party and has had a major influence in shifting the political debate in this country.
Good morning. It's good to see so many people who are able to resist the lure of outdoor activity on this. Looks like the first day of spring outside today. Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Donald T. Critchlow is a professor of history at St. Louis University, but he also serves as editor of two of the more important scholarly publications in our discipline, the Journal of Policy History and the Cambridge Essential Histories. Professor Critchlow was educated at San Francisco State University and earned his graduate degrees at the University of California at Berkeley. He's written widely on topics ranging from a history of Studebaker Corporation to the Brookings Institution. More recently, he has written about various aspects of the modern conservative movement. His book, The Conservative Ascendancy, How the GOP Right Made Political History, has been reviewed and received with enthusiasm by those interested in understanding the political and social history of the past 50 years. Please welcome Don Critchlow.
Thank you, George. And thank you for coming on this beautiful day. I come here with good news and bad news for Democrats. The good news is the conservatives are in disarray. The bad news is the conservatives aren't going anywhere. They're going to be around for a long time. In fact, I would suggest to Obama that being a unifier, that he could unify the Republican Party by putting Hillary Clinton on the ticket with him. Of course, that might cause him to take up smoking again, but I don't know. We've witnessed an important political transformation in America in the last 50 years, and that is the rise of a conservative movement that transformed the Republican Party and has had a major influence in shifting the political debate and policy debate in this country. And so we don't want to be in a position of dismissing this important political transformation that's occurred. We don't know whether this ascendancy will continue or not, but I think there are important lessons to be learned in why this transformation occurred. You might want to keep in mind that the last liberal to be elected to the presidency, running as a liberal, was Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1964, 50 years ago. The rise of the right in the last 50 years was not accident. Was largely accidental. It wasn't a linear movement. It was there was a good deal of fortune in the rise of the right. And this coincided with a good deal of misfortune and the foibles of the Democratic left. In other words, one can't understand the rise of the right without understanding the mistakes that the Democratic Party and the left made. How did this transformation occur? Why did the right wing secede and modern liberals fail? Many historians and political scientists, as well as journalists, have proposed what I would call a racial backlash theory. That is, that the rise of conservatism was really reflected in a racial backlash in the South, which the Republicans were going to seize and make a backbone into their party. At the same time, many journalists have kind of proposed, along with the racial backlash, kind of a switching bait in which corporate interests backed Republicans. Republicans were able to kind of bait the voters with social issues, abortion, homosexual marriage, and issues related to gender equality, and get them to vote Republican. And then once in office, Republicans would pursue their real agenda of serving corporate interests, deregulating the economy, and so forth, while ignoring the social issues. We might pick up this bait and switch argument in the question and answer, and we want to save some time for that, for the question and answers. But let me take on just for a moment this racial backlash theory, which I do challenge in great detail in my book, Conservative Ascend: How the GOP Made Political History. We begin by noting that the transformation of the South into a Republican stronghold really began in the 1950s. That is before the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. It began on the presidential level, and then would work its way through the congressional districts. But even more important, it's worth noting, is that the Republican strategy and the Republican success was going to be found in the suburbs. It wasn't going to be found in rural areas that were in which you found avid white segregationist support. Instead, Republicans were going to be able to mobilize in the suburbs around not issues of race, but around issues of low taxes, family values, national defense. Those are the issues that mobilize Southern white voters, and one sees the strength of the Republican Party today in the suburban areas. I only point out that Newt Gingrich wasn't coming from the rural South, he was coming from the suburb in Atlanta. That is, these white suburban voters were concerned with low taxes and unionism, family values, and eventually they would move into the Republican Party. And moreover, many of these white suburban voters in the South were moving from the North. It wasn't that they were just fleeing the inner cities of southern cities to move out to the suburbs. They were coming from the North. Put more succinctly, it was economics, not race, that won the South for the Republican. The burgeoning suburban middle classes went Republican in 1980, and the elections which followed were based on the promises of low taxes, as well as social issues. Now, some of you might still doubt this, but let me give you, I'm not going to fill the talk with a bunch of statistics, but let me give you this figure for you to, these figures to ponder. In 1976, when Jimmy Carter won election to the presidency, he carried around 79% of those districts that were carried by George Wallace in 1968. In other words, Carter was winning where George Wallace had won. And in 1980, when Ronald Reagan won, and he wins he sweeps the South, in that election, Carter still won the majority of districts that had voted for Wallace in 1968. Even in 1980, when you can see the Democrats retreating in the South, there's Carter still picking up those votes that had gone for Wallace. What this suggests to me is that George Wallace, was not a bridge candidate for white voters in the South into the Republican Party. So instead of the racial backlash theory, what I propose in my book, in detail in my book, are what I think could be boiled down to three factors. that were critical in the rise of the Republican Party and the GOP right in particular. First, the ability of the right to generate new ideas. Second, its capacity for organization, especially the establishment of new think tanks, policy institutes. And third, the emergence of leaders such as Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, and Newt Gingrich, who were able to articulate conservative principles to a larger electorate. To begin with, the invigoration of conservative ideas in the post-war period was a circumstantial result of the arrival of a group of intellectuals from Europe who came to America in response, fleeing both fascist Europe as well as communist Soviet Union. From Russia came Ayn Rand, who would become a best-selling novelist. Austria contributed two economists, Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises. German-born and Austrian-educated Eric Vogelin and German Leo Strauss provided new political ideas, while others in America, young intellectuals, infused American conservatism with a new vibrancy and new intellectual energy. And this occurred at the very time when modern liberal ideas, which were rooted in early 20th century progressive thought and European socialism, appeared spent. The arrival of these intellectuals, this small band of intellectuals, would give vibrancy to the right and would and energize the right. And would create deep and enduring philosophical principles that would continue in the right for the next 50 years. The small band of intellectuals would join together in the 1950s with a popular anti-communist movement that was found in many local communities across the country. It was popular. And most of these people who were participating in these local anti-communist movements were not intellectuals. They were reading different kinds of things, but they were concerned about communism in America and the threat of Soviet communism. So it was these two forces that came together, these intellectuals that were joined together with the popular anti-communist movement that would lay the foundation for the GOP right. Now, I think it's important to note that there were fundamental differences within this intellectual movement, and the Cold War intensified debates within this intellectual community. My point here is that from the very get-go, conservatives were fighting with one another. There were an array of questions that they confronted. For instance, should the right compromise its principles of small government in support of the Cold War? Did the United States have the right to intervene militarily and politically in the affairs of another country to prevent a perceived communist takeover? Should government restrict civil liberties of communists in the United States? Now, these debates were largely philosophical in nature, but they were heated, they were passionate, and they were often personal. The right was fighting one another, people on the right were fighting one another, but that added vibrancy and energy to the movement. And it attracted, moreover, younger students who were tired of hearing in their classrooms professors talk about what was occurring in the day, existentialism and Freudianism. And so suddenly students were reading Ayn Rand and Friedrich Hayek. And I think these two figures, Hayek and Rand, really captured the imagination of young people at the time. Hayek had written a book while he was a professor at the London School of Economics, The Road to Serfdom, which had become a bestseller. It was first published in England and then republished by the University of Chicago Press. By the way, he couldn't find a commercial publisher in this country willing to take it on. So University of Chicago published it. And within a year, it had become a bestseller. Reader's Digest had issued a popular edition of it. And it sold about 300,000 copies in the first year. I might add that Road to Serfdom's a pretty difficult read for today's students. Ayn Rand had begun writing and novels, and she captured this the imagination of young people. And for many young people at the time, Ayn Rand was their first introduction to conservatism. The worth noting, too, I think, that Ayn Rand didn't like Hayek. In fact, she thought Hayek's ideas were dangerous. She didn't agree with what he called marginal rights. Hayek had suggested that at times government had the right to regulate the economy. Rand was shocked by this. She said either freedom was unrestricted or it was restricted liberty. And she also said either that we had an unregulated economy or a regulated economy. This this debate on the right was acerbic and at times personal. I think we can see what was occurring was a whole confluence of ideas that were going to come together. And this leads to the second factor. That is organization. And critical to the next stage in the conservative revolt was the creation of new policy institutions, think tanks. And these think tanks would represent ideological positions on the right. They weren't, it wasn't a monolithic movement or a creation of corporate interests coming together and establishing these think tanks. It begins with the revitalization of an older research institute, the American Enterprise Institute, which I'll speak at tomorrow, by the way, just in case if you happen to be in Washington and want to rehear this talk. as well as the creation of new institutions, such as the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute. AEI was the kind of establishment conservative institution. Heritage is going to be much more doctrinaire, and Cato is going to be libertarian. I think the importance of the establishment of these research institutions is that it creates a kind of managerial conservatism. That is, it reflects that conservatives are now beginning to think about governance, how to create countervailing policies, alternative policies to the established modern liberal order. Coinciding with the emergence of these think tanks was the coming together of a group of intellectuals who would desert the Democratic Party, and that was the neoconservatives. Neoconservatives were not of one mind about politics or political ideology. Many refused to accept the conservative label, and many remained Democrats. Maybe we could pick up questions about neoconservatives in the Q&A. And this brings us to the third factor in explaining the rise of the right. The success had as much to do with the emergence of leaders such as Ronald Reagan as it did the failure of Democratic Party leadership. Let me explain. In 1972, the swing to the left in the Democratic Party under George McGovern enabled Richard Nixon to ignore the conservative wing of his own party when he was seeking re-election. Nixon won re-election only to be forced from office in August 1974 because of the Watergate scandal. The scandal left the Republican Party demoralized and marginalized. Less than 20% of the electorate in 1974 declared itself Republican. Many spoke of the Republican Party going the way of the Whig Party. Within that marginal party, conservatives were marginalized. They were a marginalized group within a marginal party. Following Richard Nixon's resignation from office, Gerald Ford stepped into the White House, kind of an accident of politics. And he continued to pursue Nixon's domestic policies, as well as his foreign policy, that is detente and arms control with the Soviet Union. And this ignited a backlash within the Republican Party. The right would rally around a rising star in the GOP, Ronald Reagan, who would challenge Ford for the nomination for the Republican nomination in 1976. After a very bigger primary contest, Ford was able to win the nomination, only to be defeated in the general election by Jimmy Carter. Now, what would have happened, I ask you, if Reagan had won the nomination in 1976? My guess is that Reagan or any other Republican that would have defeated Ford at that point would have lost in 1976 to Jimmy Carter. And if Reagan had lost, that would have largely ended his presidential political career. And it would have meant, I conjecture in the book, that it would have meant the end of the Republican right for a long time, because the party would have moved back toward a moderate direction, back toward the center, after having experienced two monumental defeats with Goldwater and then Reagan. So Carter comes into the office in the White House in 1976, only to experience, as you'll recall, runaway inflation, oil shortages, and a crisis in Iran that left the administration paralyzed. But equally important, the Democratic left in 1980 broke with Carter over his domestic policies, over his waffling on the abortion issue, over his appearance of not doing enough for women and their struggle for the Equal Rights Amendment, and then his get tough foreign policy after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Meanwhile, conservatives seized upon the social issues, such as abortion, gender equality, and gay rights, to build a powerful and well-organized faction within the GOP. I might remind you, too, just a thought that just came to me, that in 1980, the National Organization for Women refused to endorse Carter in that election against Reagan. Reagan wins an office. It appears that the wins the White House. We have the so-called Reagan Revolution. The Republican right appears triumphant. But in 1988, George H.W. Bush comes into office. He appears to turn his back on the Republican right. This allows a centrist new Democrat, Bill Clinton, to win election in 1992. Once again, the right looks like it's lost, but out on the canvas, not able to get up. But instead, Newt Gingrich comes along, and the Republicans win control of Congress in 94. It looks, at this point, if you recall, Clinton is out. People don't expect him to even win re-election. But very astutely and quite adeptly, Clinton defeats the Republicans. Newt Gingrich looks incompetent. Books are written saying "Shut up, Newt," and it looks like the Democrats have usurped taking the Republican agenda. But what happens? A personal scandal involving Clinton allows Republicans to win election in 2000. The 2000 election, on all appearances, should have been won by the Democrats. The economy was fairly strong. It was an incumbent presidency, and the nation is at peace. But instead, the Republicans win. So what can we conclude from this? We should conclude two things, and I'll stop here. First of all, we should conclude that the rise of conservatism was not a straight trajectory from nowhere to somewhere. Secondly, we should conclude there was a good deal of accident in this rise, and much of the good fortune of the right has come about from the left. Maybe this is something to keep in mind as we approach the next election. That is to say that Republicans should continue to have hope that they might win, that the Democrats will mess up once again. But maybe the lesson is that maybe the Democrats have learned something from history, and if it's from me, that means that we'll have earned a little bit of money from having sold a book to them. So not enough for my retirement, though. So let's take some questions. Thank you very much.
In just a minute, I'll move to the back of the room, and those who have questions, and I already see some hands and excited eyes ready to ask questions.
No stones, though.
No stones.
Show me the exit.
Should queue up in the back of the room. Let me open up, Don, with saying that anybody who gets elected president is going to have a basket full of problems to address, both the public and the private debt crisis, inflation fueled by oil prices and other factors, as well as crises in both hemispheres of the world. Apparently, we're getting ready to have some action in South America now, in addition to everything going on in the Middle East. What would be the conservative agenda, not necessarily the McCain Republican agenda, but what would be the conservative agenda for a new president?
I think that's a good question. And I think the point I was trying to make in the talk is that there's not a single conservative point of view. I think this was evident in the very heated debate in the right over the Iraq war. Many of the conservative magazines have been very critical of Bush and the Iraq war. So I don't think there's a single conservative point of view. I do think that there are general, but I'm not suggesting that there isn't a thing such a thing as conservatism. There is, but I think for the next, Republican administration will be concerned with pursuing Republican policies of low taxes, trying to turn government programs as much back toward local and state stakes. There's a general distrust of on the right of centralized government. They think that centralized government is ultimately a threat to liberties. And there's going to be a concern with national defense, I think, on the part of any Republican administration. And finally, and most importantly, there's going to be a concern with appointing judges who are not perceived as activist judges. What's happened in terms of policies in the last, public policy in the last 30 years, is a lot of it's not being conducted through through democratic debate, but through debate among the judges.
Thank you very much for a thoughtful analysis. I'm very surprised you haven't mentioned William Buckley as a force in the conservative movement. I would say in the 1950s, the term intelligent conservative was an oxymoron. And as we see the career with National Review and all of those folks, Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, Newt Gingrich, all have credited William Buckley with a huge amount of their ideas and the synthesis that he brought to bear. And I just would like your views about that fine man who died a few days ago.
Yes, thank you very much for that. In fact, it's one of the problems with not following my script and just trying to ad lib a little bit. In my notes, I talk about William Buckley, and that was an oversight on my part. I don't think that it's hard to imagine the conservative movement having taken the form it did without William Buckley. This shows the importance of an actor, actor in terms of being a theatrical actor, but an actor in history. Men and women, the role of a single individual in history. Without William Buckley, I think people such as Hayek and others would have had the kind of importance that they would have later. I will say that there was going to be, on the other hand, there was going to be intellectual influence being exerted in the realm of economics, and so it wasn't singly William Buckley. And in particular, I think the University of Chicago, the Department of Economics, was absolutely critical in this. There was a kind of a coming together of free market economists, including Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman's ideas were going to be influential. And also, just by the way, out of University of Virginia, out of University of Chicago also came the Journal of Law and Economics, which introduced economic thinking into law. And that was going to transform law. Bork is going to be influenced by it, Robert Bork, as well as Richard Posner. One final thought. But intellectuals were important. But without the popular movement of anti-communist, I think the intellectuals would have remained isolated. Ideas are important, ideas have consequences, but the people have a grassroots movement is equally consequential. So it was these two forces coming together that would give rise to the right, and then they're going to find political leaders that are able to articulate principles, intellectual principles that Buckley and Friedman and others had written. Other questions written about?
Hi, Brian Vallow. I'm in the history department at UVA and co-chair the Governing in America in a Global Era program here at the Miller Center.
Brian, thank you for introducing yourself. We've known one another for 30 years at least. I knew you when you were a young graduate student. So remember, we're friends. Go ahead with your question.
That, truth be told, Don taught me how not to spill soup on myself at a job interview. And I have a question, actually, that gets back at least 25 years. But first, I did want to thank you for your service to the field of history. Most of these folks, because it's spring break here at UVA, we don't have our academic contingent, and most of these folks are what I call civilians. So they would not know the thousands of hours, thankless hours, that you've devoted to creating and running the Journal of Policy History, which has become the leading journal in its field. And so, first of all, I just want to thank you for your service to history.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. And for now, trying, lay on your question.
Okay. I first encountered your work through your book on the Brookings Institution, and you, better than anybody I know, are in a position to compare and contrast the way a establishment liberal think tank went about influencing ideas and public policy compared to, let's say, American Enterprise Institute or Heritage Foundation, which I know you address in your book. So my question is, what are the differences between these two approaches?
Yes, I think that's a good question, and involved one I spend an entire chapter talking about think tanks. And I think the what's critical isn't so much what they do, but the context in which that's occurring when they're doing it. And the American Enterprise Institute is at the forefront in the 70s of deregulation. They're promoting ideas to deregulate the economy. It comes along at a time when liberals are also thinking about deregulating the economy. So that gives traction to ideas. Maybe another way of putting this is that at any given time, there are all kinds of ideas floating around, and policy ideas and intellectual ideas. And at certain times, ideas just seem to take on traction, either because of the mood of the people or what's happening in the economy or socially. And I think that's what happens with AEI and Heritage. Heritage is started primarily to translate policy to Congress. So they find not only are they promoting pretty doctrinaire conservative ideas, they've singled out their market to get policy ideas within very quick turnaround time to Congress. And they also find a medium to do that in their one-pagers. That is, congressmen are very, very busy, so they provide a one-page summaries of what the issues are. I think more problematic is a group such as Cato, which is libertarian. They've been very opposed to the war. They're on social issues. They're for unregulated behavior. Libertarian ideas have had importance among conservative intellectuals, and I think they've had importance among Republicans. Their ideas have been less easily translated into policy, however. So, other questions, please.
Well, you talked about the divisions within the conservative movement, suggest that it's not really one movement, but with many different groups and interests, and we hear a lot about that today. But as you look at that history, do you find some moments, especially where those divisions were becoming rather sharp and there was some talk of a crack up or something that might be permanent?
Oh, yes. There's always a talk of a crack up among conservatives. And I think it's often talk found quite prevalent on the left. They have great dreams of this crack up, this view that conservatives are in particular disarray comes after the end of the Cold War. The argument being that the Cold War held conservatives together, the Soviet Union did, and now there's going to be a fight among conservatives, in particular the social conservatives, as well as the economic conservatives, that is, kind of the business wing. There's no doubt that there's tensions between the economic conservatives and the social conservatives at time, but I do think it's important to note that successful Republican candidates in winning election, that is on the presidential level, always argued for Republican economic policy. This idea that that Reagan didn't talk about the economy and just mobilized social conservatives, or that's what George W. Bush did. I mean, presuming that he's a conservative, and I'm willing to accept that, that and that they've always argued economic ideas along with social issues. In other words, in election time, these two forces are going to be less astute than the kind of the debate that's raging in conservative magazines and columns. And it's just I think that Republicans election time, in the same way it happens in the left, brings people together, and they're going to forget a lot of their differences. But one final point: if a Republican does not rally the conservative base of the party, that is, the social conservatives, he or she is going to have trouble. The importance isn't the turning, as you often hear on television, is turning people out to vote. The religious right electorate is a significant voting bloc. But the importance is in their campaigns themselves. You need to have people going down to making phone calls, distributing leaflets, going out and picking up voters to take them to the polls. That's where the religious right in many states, coming out of their churches, that's fundamental to Republican success. And I will say that just one final thing that might interest you, perhaps it will, I don't know, that in 2004, George Bush put together a very well orchestrated and organized machine. This came at a time when many political scientists were talking about the party organization doesn't matter anymore, the ideology doesn't matter anymore, that we're in this kind of new world. But what George Bush did, and his Republican strategist, is organize on the local level, through district levels, up through the national office, in which people were down in the grassroots were given quotas about how many phone calls to make, how many leaflets to distribute, and how many voters to get to the polls. And that turned out to be critical in that election. It was a very well-organized party machine. One of the problems, I think, that one of the problems with the Democrats, they've put together clearly a grassroots campaign beginning with modeled on Howard Dean. This is evident in the Obama campaign through internet. But one of the problems for the Democrats is that these people that have been organized through, these activists that have been organized through the internet, aren't necessarily loyal to the Democratic Party. They're kind of working outside the Democratic Party. And what this suggests to me, if a Democrat does win election, and if Obama in particular wins election, and he doesn't fulfill his campaign promises, these people these activists will take to the streets, and won't necessarily have any loyalty to the Democratic Party. Historically, the Republican Party has been much better organized than the Democratic Party. And I think that continues to be the case, even while it looks like the Democratic Party today has a lot of energy. Another question.
Hi, I'm very much a civilian, even within this crowd. I guess I'd best describe myself as Team Mom. And my family is 10 and a half hours in India, or 7 hours ahead in Istanbul, or six. Wow. And anyway, the point is, my world is global at this point. I saw your resume. I was very much, I'm of your age group. I was in academia, going to school in the 70s, and so I feel as if you and I have a sort of shared cultural experience. This weekend, I love The Temptations with a sociology UVA friend who goes back to the 70s with me. And so looking at it all with maybe a different lens, rather than looking backward and using labels like conservative and liberal, is it possible that we're in a true midlife crisis, which of course I'm midlife, and so I wonder, I use those terms. Is it possible that our country's politics will no longer be simplistically described as conservative or liberal? Because personally, on 100 issues, I'm all over the map, be they conservative or liberal. And I don't think I'm alone. The others in my family are all over the map, no longer the terms that we used in the 70s.
I didn't catch your name.
Sorry, my name's Gwyneth Rankin.
All right. Well, I'm a little ahead of you, Gwen. I experienced my midlife crisis early.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I was 26 at the time. The I think we all, I mean, first of all, we are living in a much more globalized world. We have been since really the Second World War. I mean, Second World War was, in fact, a pretty globalized time, I think, in a bad way. But we're living in a new world in which there's greater trade and greater communication. I think the great irony about this is in this new world of communication is that there's we're probably getting along less these days than we, you know, since at any point in our history. As we've gotten to know one another, as we've gotten to know one another, it hasn't necessarily led to love between us. I think that's important. Now, I also think that in fact we appear to be more segmented in many ways. We're as Americans and as a nation, we're experiencing new challenges that we've never confronted before. Not only just with terrorism, but with trade. And as we enter into, like, say, this new period in history, we all want, as Americans, to come together and to be unified and to agree with one another and to march forward as a people, proud of our nation and addressing the problems within our nation and the problems for the world. But in the end, there's going to be, I think, differences among us. And those differences, I think, are good. And I think that it's good that we have this kind of debate that goes on in this country. In the 19th century, as we arose, as Brian Bellow will tell us, as we arose to be a strong nation, the politics was nastier, it was personal, there would be accusations made against politicians that we would find absolutely abhorrent today. So just because we're debating and we have this heated politics isn't necessarily bad. In fact, I think it shows the maturity of democracy. And so I encourage that kind of debate. But ultimately, there are fundamental differences that need to be hashed out politically. We have, in many ways, a divided culture. And I'm not taking sides in suggesting this. We have, on one side, a secular culture that defines freedom in another way, of individuals finding expression through basically secular values. On the other hand, we have a very significant population that's Christian, that thinks that and Jewish, that think that ultimately a healthy nation has to have religious values and transcendent values in order to survive as a nation. And those kinds of differences, and it translates into all kinds of political and policy debates. And those type of differences can't be simply patched up by saying, well, I have different views and I'm not ideologue, and therefore nobody else should be ideological. And we could take, and we could go down, and there's fundamental differences about what government should do. Some people think that, you know, want the conservatives in general want to place more emphasis on individual responsibility, on local and private efforts, while the liberals think that there should be a greater representation of the common good, that the community needs to protect those people that are weak. And those are fundamental, philosophical differences that they are not going to be plastered over in some kind of way. So that's my own view about this. I think they still do. I think liberalism and conservatism is going to change, and you know, and expand in certain ways. But maybe the one way of answering your question is to say that today, about 40% of the electorate defines themselves as conservative. 15% describe themselves as progressive.
I get a strange disconnect between the conservative philosophy and this administration's abysmal activities in terms of conservation of natural resources. I mean, if you're going to conserve something, probably the most important thing right now for the future of our country and future of the world and our children and grandchildren is to protect the natural resources that we have. There are going to be tremendous crises in global water and global warming, all of these things, and this administration is turning its back on it. So let's talk about maybe selective conservatism rather than, that's what seems to me that's going on, rather than really true conservatism here.
Well, again, there's a debate within conservative circles over issues such as global warming. Not all conservatives believe that that global warming is just kind of a natural occurrence. Some conservatives have said that they think that men and or humans are contributing to it. But I don't want to, in terms of the administration and its conservation policies, I think it reflects a Republican agenda that there's other ways of handling conservation issues other than, as you may be suggesting, signing the Kyoto agreements.
Drilling in Anwar and breaking the wildlife preserves by building roads through them and logging them. Those are things that I think are very bad for our future of this country.
I think I understand your point. Anwar would contribute about 2% to our oil reserves. Interestingly enough, American dependency on Arabian oil has declined. The Europeans and Japanese are much more reliant on Middle Eastern oil. I know you're talking about conservation, but the fact of the matter is that we're less dependent, we're still very dependent on Middle Eastern oil for our economy. And as George Gillen suggested, this is a major issue that's going to confront any administration. And I think any hopes of trying to turn around the economy in the next 4 years, so it becomes non-oil dependent or even considerably less oil dependent, is not going to happen, unfortunately. So I think foreign policy and conservation are important. I agree with you that by the way, that there's major problems with water, healthy water in many parts of the world. In fact, I think China confronts a major problem in this regard. I do have faith, probably a faith that you may not have, But in the end, we've as Hillary Clinton said, there's not a problem that there isn't a solution for. Often we found technological solutions for our problems. This isn't to say that we shouldn't conserve, but I do think when we're confronted with problems, technology has often addressed those problems. Let's hope that it does in this next in the future. I can see you shaking your head, so I can see. At least I've kept you awake. Something new for me with my students. So anyway.
I'd be interested in hearing your views on Senator McCain as the Republican nominee.
I think what was interesting about this election is that the conservatives really kind of rally around anyone. There was a good deal of opposition, in fact, toward Huckabee. He's kind of tapped into this conservative base. He did, speaking of internet, he did something very interesting. One of his strategists down in Tennessee, or over in Tennessee, had a list of how he worked. He was kind of one of these right-wing entrepreneurs that's not fully trusted by some people on the right, but he had a huge database that had been built from Mel Gibson's Passion, the movie The Passion. And he gave that database to Huckabee, and that was used in rallying his support in Iowa. The many conservatives, especially on the evangelical side, just couldn't accept Romney because he was a Mormon. We could go all the way down the line. So in fact, they didn't have a candidate. And now some of them are upset with McCain. Because on many issues, McCain hasn't gone the way of the way the conservatives have wanted. And you know these areas, from immigration to issues of torture to global warming, and also has been very successful in organizing bipartisan caucuses, which really upset, especially on the appointment of judges, that really upset the right. In the end, I think the right will come around to McCain, and you already begin to see this discussion. And I think there, in some ways, right at this moment, Obama has the right and a little bit of disorientation because they were expecting to run against Hillary. But I think once if Obama gets the nomination, you'll find the right coming together. But in general, McCain isn't, I don't think, he's clearly not an ideological conservative, although there are some conservative principles that he accepts. Right to life for one thing, and downsizing government. So it's going to be interesting that what happens. I do think if McCain gets into office, if he wins the office, he's not only going to confront these huge problems that were referred to that just seem overwhelming. Just not conservation, but I mean problems with hemispheric problems, a weakening in economy, inflation, oil shortages. And that's going to be, that's whoever gets in, especially think McCain, is going to experience problems within Congress that will continue to be probably divided. And he's going to experience problems with the right wing. All I can say is it's a lot easier to write about presidents in the past than it is to think about becoming one in the future. So on that modest note.
For many, regardless of how they may label themselves, Roe v. Wade has been kind of the defining issue. There are some who feel that now, having been the law for 35 years, that it's well-settled law and should not be disturbed by, quote, an activist court. There are others who feel that they want their president to pledge to appoint judges who are determined to overturn that law. What do you sense will be the conservative attitude towards changing Roe v. Wade in the years to come?
Yes, I think if there's a likelihood, perhaps even a strong likelihood, that Roe v. Wade will be overturned. In many ways, it's already been overturned in Webster. I won't go into the details of that, but that ruling was greatly modified. But what does it mean? I think we should ask ourselves, George, what it means if Roe v. Wade is overturned. What it means is there's going to be that the abortion issue will be turned back to the states. And maybe it would have been better there anyway. One of the books you didn't mention is that I've written on birth control and family planning. It was I wrote a book on this. In fact, I spoke at the Miller Center on that book. And what happened with Roe v. Wade, it really sparked a backlash on the grassroots, beginning with the Catholics and then traditional Catholics, and later spread to evangelicals. But there was a debate going on on the state level over the issue of abortion. And many states had reformed their abortion laws. Most states had abortion laws. It's not true that there wasn't, that abortion was illegal before Roe v. Wade. It wasn't. States it was just highly regulated. That one, for a woman to have an abortion, it had to be for medical reasons. And it was becoming strictly enforced at a time when, in the 60s, over medical abortions with measles and so forth. There was a reform movement that took, with the measles epidemic and thalidomide and concerns with malformities with children. And then, but in the 70s, late 60s, there was a movement to liberalize abortion laws on the state level. And there was a debate that was occurring. And most states, as I started to say, had reformed their abortion laws. And it probably, on hindsight, would have been healthier if we had had that debate on the state level in politics. Now what would happen if it's turned back to the state, getting to the question that I first asked? My guess is that abortion laws would pretty much remain the same. I think Americans in general have an agreement that abortion isn't good, but they want it regulated. And they do not want abortion on demand. On the other hand, they don't want to overturn and make it unconstitutional. So you'll have a debate that will occur on the state level. I think most states will allow abortion to be remain to be legalized. There may be a few states that, in the Dakotas, that make it illegal, but I don't think this is really going to change much. Really, it's become kind of a symbolic, heated issue. But if you begin to give some thought to it about what really is going to happen, I don't think much, except. It might really revive the women's movement, because they would have something to organize around in the on the state level. So I don't know about this. I'm a historian. I only predict the past. I don't predict the future. So that's kind of what my thinking is. But I may be absolutely totally wrong on this one. So I may be totally wrong about everything. But thank you for listening to me. I really appreciate it.